Morena, and welcome to Sobriety Chat. I'm your host, Lotta Dan, otherwise known as Mrs. D. I am the community manager and content creator here at Living Sober. And today I am joined by the incredible Amanda Bradley. I managed to snaffle her after a chat at a hooey we were both at recently. Now, Amanda is a mother of two adult children. She is married. She lives through her lived experience. She's a yoga fan, a water fan, loves fishing, and she's a real leader in mental health, addictions, and lived experience space. So I'm chuffed to have you here, Amanda. Good morning.
Good morning, Lotta. It's lovely to be here. So thank you for inviting me along.
Yes, and it's a Sunday morning, and that just shows how committed we are to these conversations. Yeah,
absolutely. I did get to lie in until 9:30, though. Amazing.
Oh, no, really appreciate you. So I do want to get to the mahi you do and the work you do in the space of addiction and lived experience in particular, but let's hear a bit about your story first, because you are a person in recovery. Can you tell us a bit about your drinking story? How did it start for you? How did your relationship with alcohol begin?
Yeah, well, look, to be honest, Lotta, it's a lifetime relationship. And I think about where does this start quite often, actually. And if I think right back to my childhood, it was quite normal from an early age to have, I remember my very first glass of red wine was in a little liqueur glass with our Saturday night roast dinner. To be honest, I was only probably about 7 or 8. But it was always seen as a special treat. And then as I was sort of growing up through the years, it was just a regular normal thing. And I had quite a privileged upbringing, so there was always alcohol in the house. I don't recall my father ever not drinking. There was always, you know, every night as soon as he got home from work, it was a drink. And of course, my mum went along with that as well. So when I became a teenager and in their eyes was a lot more acceptable, I too had a drink when I got home from, you know, whether it was uni or whatever it was at the time. And certainly weekends from a very early age at barbecues and Christmas holidays, there was just always alcohol on the go. Back in those days, it was the good old Miami wine coolers.
Oh, gosh, I haven't heard those.
I know, exactly. Mind you, they're probably quite innocent compared to what's around today. And then as I moved through into adulthood, you know, people I mixed with were all big drinkers. Again, you celebrated, it was alcohol. If you were tired, it was alcohol. If you were sad, it was alcohol. If you went through a relationship breakup, it was alcohol. So that was just always the natural go-to. Fast track that through probably my first relationship, which had my first marriage actually, which was pretty much driven by alcohol. We were both big drinkers. And then I separated, and then that's when I really hit the slippery slope. I was lonely, couldn't afford to go out, but I could afford to buy my 1 or 2 bottles of wine a day and sit at home and started drinking my own. And that was kind of the beginning of probably some of the worst moments in this journey.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And lots of big, uncomfortable feelings. Before we get to that kind of descent into the madness, if we want to call it that, been there, done that, by the way. Back to those early days, like teenage and 20s, when it was just becoming a normal way, was it casual, or did you always feel a real pull towards it? Like, oh, I like this stuff. I like how it makes me feel. Or did it start quite casually where you were able to take it or leave it?
No, I don't think I've ever been able to take it or leave it. If I look back, that very first drink, I still remember, I can still feel it in myself and remember having this drink and thinking, oh, that's nice. And then I was quite a shy child, and then in my teenage years I always felt really awkward. So if I was to have friends around, or mum and dad were to have friends, or if we went out, the first thing I'd go for is a drink just to make me feel more comfortable. And then, you know, I found that actually I could be the life of the party, and I was fun, and people kind of gravitated towards me, and I liked that. And so that was the beginning of where alcohol felt really good.
Yeah, and if you are shy, introverted, awkward, I mean, most teenagers are one or more of those things, you know, why wouldn't you turn to this readily available, normalized liquid that everyone's glugging? But it's such a slippery trap, isn't it? Because you then think, I need the alcohol to be that interesting person. Without it, I'm boring. And that is a mind trap in a society that favours extroversion, social butterfly-ness. If I had a dollar for everyone that said to me they got sober and realised they were introverted and like small gatherings and time alone, I would be a very rich woman.
Absolutely. Hey, and I want to come back to something that you said there, Lotta, on where, you know, if we don't drink, we'll be boring. Because when we get to my story of stopping, that was very much what I heard. You're boring now, you know. So that's something that I had to work through as well.
Yeah, and was one of the biggest fears for me when I was getting close to quitting was I'm going to be boring. But, okay, let's get to that. Firstly, when you were building up to that, again, using the phrase descent into, you know, when things started getting really heavy and out of control, did you have prior to that any kind of inner voice of worry? What was your, were you just sort of boozing happily, thinking this is normal, this is how people live? Or did you have any kind of internal relationship with the drinking and feeling like maybe
there was something absolutely. Look, it was both internal and external. I remember friends being worried at, you know, for me. I made some really crazy wild decisions based around my drinking that, you know, to be honest, I actually think I'm quite lucky to be alive today with some of the things I did in my teens and my early 20s. Looking back now, just crazy. So I knew that actually this isn't good. I also had my father was an alcoholic. His father was, and father's father. So I was really aware of this. However, the family never spoke of it. So it was just something in me that I thought, this is not good.
Right. So there was some internal stuff there, but then all that pressure of society. And like you say, the big feelings, you know, let's be honest, alcohol works in the moment. It does what we want.
Yeah.
It does what we want chemically.
It
works. People who drink aren't idiots. It works. Yeah. Even when we know the negatives, we do it because this is the tricky thing, because there's that pull there. Okay, so then you have the big sort of life shift with a separation and divorce and the big feelings and the loneliness, and things start turning bad. What happened?
Yeah, well, if I go back just before the separation, so, you know, mother's group, and I'd just like to, you know, put a shout out to all new mums on here too, Lotta. This is a really difficult time for mothers. It's, you know, it's so easy to sit in that evening and think, oh, I've had a hard day, have a wine. So the mother's group was the start of it at our antenatal or postnatal, you know, mother's groups. On a Friday, we'd have our morning session together, and the wine would come out come 12 o'clock, and the husbands would have to pick us up on the way home. So again, I got into a real drinking culture in my mother's group. Fast tracked that a couple of years and left my husband, and that was just my go-to. I loved it. I enjoyed wine. I really wanted to go out, but I had no one that could babysit the children because I was living away from my supports, and that's how I drowned my sorrows. It got to a stage, and, you know, the children would have only been sort of 7, 8 by this stage, where they'd say to me at night, "Mum, please don't drink." Mm-hmm. So that broke my heart. And, you know, I really high functioning during the day, although I wouldn't feel great. But, you know, I had a really important job at the time.
Isn't it amazing what we can do?
Totally, totally. And yet driving home, I'd say, I'm not going to drink today. And I would turn into the bottle store and buy my bottle of wine, get home, have a couple before dinner. Then after dinner, I would say to myself, I'm only going to have 2 before dinner. Then after dinner, while the kids were doing their thing, I'd have another one. And then because we had a bottle store literally through an alleyway at the end of the road, I would then walk down and buy myself another bottle of wine. So I'd never buy 2 at the time. I'd go back later and buy 1 because I didn't want to have 2 in the house.
That's what I did.
Yeah. And I knew every step of the way, I knew driving home, I don't want to do this.
No, that disconnect, that's the internal impact of addiction that you can't, we can talk about it here and write about it till the cows come home, but when you feel it on the inside, that disconnect of what you're trying to do and who you're trying to be, and then that pull, and then that doing that stuff that you told yourself an hour ago you weren't going to do, it's really, really, really deeply negatively impactful, isn't it?
Well, it is. And you just feel you've got no control.
Yeah.
You know, I've always thought I was quite a strong person, and yet here was this thing that I should be able to say no to. And yet, honestly, the power that would just make me I keep thinking I'm going to drive past, and then I'd turn into the car park.
Yeah. And it's your own voice convincing you.
Yes.
You work out, it's only wine. It's not like you're on heroin. You know, it's the madness of addiction.
Well, it is completely. And it doesn't matter how many times you talk to yourself and how many mornings you say, I'm going to stop. And I did, albeit, I did try. So I did try twice to stop, and I'd go like 4 or 5 weeks, and then I think, oh, I'll just have one now. And then honestly, within a week, I was back to that bottle a night again.
Yeah. So what happened that you actually stopped?
So two things, actually. First of all, I met a wonderful man who's my now husband, and we were dating long distance, actually, and he made it quite clear that he couldn't deal with my drinking. So I sort of sat on that, and I wasn't really sure what I was going to do there, because I still felt like I needed this, you know, alcohol. But what really hit me hard was the children and I were invited out for a barbecue one night, and, you know, it still makes me feel awful that this happened. But I remember quite late that night, the children waking me up in the spa pool. So I'd gotten to the spa pool and they tapped me on the shoulder. Now, I'd fallen asleep, and we know what can happen there. And it has happened to people. And then, you know, at this young age, they had to call a dial a driver, get me home in the car to home. And then the next morning I was so hungover I couldn't get them to school. And I just, that was rock bottom, absolute rock bottom. And, you know, and at that stage my now husband also said, Amanda, I won't be with you while you're drinking.
Right.
Yeah, so I couldn't get much lower than that.
A few messages coming in.
Yeah, a few messages. I'd seen my dad die of cirrhosis of the liver, and that wasn't a nice journey. And I just thought, I can't go there. I've got to change this. I've got to stop this generation. You know, my son was just entering, you know, throughout this into his, he was just about to start high school, and I thought, there's no way. There's no way I'm going to do this to them. I've got to role model that. So that was my big epiphany.
Was that the last night of drinking, or how did you do it?
Yeah, that was probably, I would have said that went on for probably a couple of weeks, and then another silly thing happened, and I drove home from being out definitely over the limit, and I was just so disgusted in myself, actually. And so that next morning, 17th of December, I remember it, I woke up and I went straight to the doctors and I said, I don't want to drink anymore. Help me. What do I do?
Wow. And they were good?
They were amazing.
Right. We get mixed reports.
Yeah.
No offense. Doctors, GPs are busy. Time is short. Yeah. But
yeah,
that's great. What did they say?
So he said, look, let's try some antabuse. And I'd sort of heard of it through my work, you know, working in the sector, but I hadn't really heard much about it. And so I tried it, and antabuse is, you know, not obviously because not everyone knows, but it makes you vomit if you have any alcohol at all, whether that's alcohol in food or a drink. And that was enough for me. So I took that and I was dedicated to it. Something shifted in my head. I thought, I'm going to do this. And so I did it. I've never had another drink since that day, 17th of December, 9 years ago.
Amazing. How many? Sorry?
Nine. 9 years. Yep. 9 years ago. It'll be 10 years this December.
Okay. So yeah. How did it go? Was it hard? Were there cravings? Was there emotional upheaval? I mean, obviously you say, you know, you just did it, but there was probably quite a bit of internal work I'm going like this.
A lot of work.
Change to get
a
to.
A lot of work.
But how did it go in the early months? I've said to you before, most of our members, people watching this, they're in that stage. What was it like for you, Amanda, and what helped?
Okay, it was lonely. It was absolutely lonely because all of my friends, all of them, including my partner, husband now, they all enjoyed drinking. And I knew I couldn't be around alcohol. So I said to my partner, I need a month to myself and just basically went away. I took myself a road trip up north and I went around the North Island for about a week, all on my own, walking to the beach, just driving, staying in little motels, just to keep myself completely away from any influence. Because what I had was all of my friends, including my family, kept saying, you don't have a problem. But now I realise they were all drinkers, including my family. I had to break away from the chatter from my friends and family and everything around me.
That's hard, actually, because it's quite not just undermining but kind of invalidating. Like you're already questioning in your own brain because of addiction and now you've got these other messages, oh, you're not that bad, it's fine. Yep. You know, that's a whole nother layer.
But you see, no one knew the things that I knew. Yeah. So no one knew that incident with the children other than the children. I have no idea if I remember you. It now.
It's 3 in the morning when you're waking up feeling guilty. Yeah, that's what I always say to people. You know the truth. You know it.
Absolutely. So I went through that and, you know, every day is a celebration and I think you've absolutely got to celebrate yourself. It's a big part of it. My part of my celebration is I thought, okay, well, if I'm spending $150 on alcohol a week, I'm going to shout myself a full body massage each week. Now, Lotta, I still do that to this day.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Amazing.
That is my gift. Yes. And so that's what I did. And the other thing that I did, you know, it's having things to distract. Instead of going for that glass of wine when I got home, I'd run my bubble bath and I'd have candles around it and I'd get into the bath until that absolutely strong, overwhelming desire started fading away. So it was about putting other things in place. And then I started meeting new friends that didn't drink. And that was a game changer because all of a sudden I could go and do things where alcohol wasn't the center of everything.
Yeah.
So that was really important. And then 3 months in, the sense of pride that you have in yourself and you think I can do this was huge. And I didn't have the cravings then. I thought about it. I felt lonely when I went out to drinks and dinner parties. I felt bored. I felt that I didn't feel the confidence. But again, if I could get home and get through the next day, it was another win. Yes. And it was another feeling of feeling empowered.
Yeah, and it's so interesting you saying that you felt bored because here we were talking earlier about how our fear is that when we get sober, we're going to get boring. And actually, you get sober and realise drunk people are boring.
Totally. And that's my new journey now.
It's smelly.
yeah, exactly. But going back to, I think, what was really hard for me, and I said I'll remind us later, was when I started on this journey, and, you know, no disrespect to my mother, she probably struggles with her own stuff, but I remember very clearly she saying, come on, have a drink. And I said, no, I'm doing this. And that's when she said, well, you're just so boring without a drink. You know, I don't think our parents and our loved ones and our friends actually realise the damage that they can do by that when you're a person that's really struggled with that alcohol.
Yeah.
It's gone full circle now and everyone, and I feel great when people do it, everyone say, God, we're proud of you. I don't know how you've done it. You're so strong. It's amazing. Well done, you. And you find yourself now, well, I do, and I'm sure you do, Lotta, find yourself in positions now supporting other people through the journey.
Oh, yeah, well, it's basically what I devote my whole life to.
Yes.
but it's interesting what you say about people questioning and being proud because I always think that the ones that say things like, you're boring now, you don't drink, and I did have it twice, or just act like they don't want to be around you at parties, like you just get a vibe, they're not really, it's always about them, actually.
And I've lost friends.
It can be hard because there's been a couple of times recently at parties where people I could see they just were avoiding me and they were boozing, and I felt sort of like, why don't you want to? I'm really not, you know, people please are desperate to be liked me. Why aren't you chatting to me? But I have to actually bring some compassion to it and not take it personally. It's not about me. It is about them, and maybe they've got that little inner voice they're trying to squash down.
Of course. Yeah.
You just have to let them be. But it's complex, isn't it? It's hard socially.
It's sometimes really complex. And it's, you know, I have lost a lot of friends. I lost what I thought were two really good friends. But, you know, it's interesting because I was just talking to my husband last night. It was our 9 years of our engagement yesterday. And I said, oh, where would we be if we hadn't got engaged? And I said, oh, well, those friends, they weren't any good for me anyway, the ones that left, because I realised they were big drinking friends and encouraging drinking friends. And then that leads me on to the point, you know, my husband said, I can't be with you while you're drinking. And he has been my stable force. And, you know, I said to him this morning, I said, you are the reason that I stopped drinking and why my career's taken off and why I'm now in this position of really wanting to talk about it and support other people on the journey. So it's kind of cool. It's done a big full circle.
So cool. How lovely. Yeah. I want to get on to what you're doing now, but just quickly about the friends thing, and you mentioned earlier the mummy groups. You know, the irony is with alcohol, we think it connects us and we use it to bond, especially women, and the industry really pushes that message on us, you know, girls together, blah, blah, have some bubbles. But it does the opposite. It disconnects. It puts a shield or a veil between that genuine connection, I now realise, so that, you know, you think you're having a great fun bonding time, but you're just boozing together.
You are. And you often, you know, you talk about things perhaps when you're boozing that you wished you hadn't talked about, whereas now, being sober, you have really deep conversations, but you want to share those things you're sharing. And you build a real depth on that now that you also remember, which is nice.
I'm just laughing because you and me at that recent hui having a chat, you know, sitting to the side at lunch by some windows, and like 5 minutes we're into parents, we're into
exactly right, do it.
The real stuff.
Yes, yeah, and I love talking real stuff. You know, and it's a big part of our jobs. But now what I can do is I can feel confident. I know what I've talked about. Yes. I don't wake up the next morning thinking, oh, my God, what did I share last night?
Yes, that's exactly right. You can rely on yourself every minute of the day.
Yeah.
Okay, so you now work at TAPO, which is the, and forgive me if I get this wrong, the National Workforce Development Organization, a sister organization to where I work, Blueprint for Learning. And you're the lived experience lead there. So you absolutely walk the talk. You bring all of your life and professional experience into this role. Can you tell me, particularly, I'm interested in this rise in recognition and framing around these lived experience peer sort of advocacy and support roles. What's happening in the space around that that's new? Yeah. New in terms of, it used to always be clinical help is the only help, and now we've got this realisation.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I have to really acknowledge the people that have gone before. You know, those that I guess back in the day were seen as, you know, activist-type roles, but that's because they were really wanting their voice heard of, you know, those that experience whatever distress it is, whether it's through a mental illness or through addiction. You know, we know what that distress is like and we know what works. And so over many, many years of people speaking to that, we've got to a place where we're actually being valued and being recognised that, wow, walking alongside someone that has been in that position works. And I know for me it was. I had a friend who had had a similar experience. She was at my bedside in the morning when I was really, really unwell mentally and with drinking. And she said, Amanda, I've been here. I'll look after you until you get through this. Very powerful. And that's what we are seeing with our peer workers in the workforce. So we know, for instance, those in ED now, the peer workers going into our emergency departments, that comfort level of when someone walks through into an emergency department, which is incredibly active and high stimulation and anxiety causing, that to have someone next to them that may have also experienced mental distress and being in an ED department, is there talking them through it, walking alongside, what do you need? Do you need time out? Should we get a cup of tea? This is what the clinician will say to you. This is the assessment they might do. Do you want me with you? So that mutuality and that mutual support, massive.
Yeah, even, I was going to say, even simple things like, I know these lights are really bright. I can remember when I was here. Let's just see if we can, why don't we move over here? Okay. You know, just that. And suddenly they're like, oh, this person gets it, really gets it.
Yep, totally. Or, hey, should we shut the curtain because everyone's staring at us when they walk past? You know, those sorts of things. So, I mean, you know, in the space of addiction, the lived experience philosophy has been happening for a long time through AA, right? So I look back at that and think, wow, they were some of the first movers and shakers in that space. But what we're seeing now, that not only do we have a government behind it, which also means these big optics on us to get things right, but that also means these funding. So we're seeing leadership roles. And those roles are to help with systems change and to help sustain this newly, well, it's not newly developed, I'd be told off for that actually, we've been around a long time, but what it's now is being recognised. So how do we support that workforce? So my role was a brand new role at TPO, and I come with both mental health issues which run through my family, but plus the addiction issues. So I feel really incredibly privileged to be able to walk alongside people, see what they want, whether it's individuals, whether it's whānau, and have a team that start preparing these really cool resources and trainings and groups to make sure we get this right, because it does work. It absolutely works.
Great. And I will link in this post links to things like the competencies framework and other things that TPO is doing in this space for anyone that's interested. Because I know a lot of our members, I say, you know, most of them are in those early stages, but we have incredible long-time members who keep coming back as lamplighters, as I would say, peer support workers in our community.
Just this is what you and I are as well, really. You know, right? That chat at the conference, it was like minds coming together, and it's like,
yeah, and just feeling that there's value in that. You're not just someone that kind of turned your life around. You're actually actively helping. And then in turn, that strengthens your own recovery. I mean, I don't know about you, but I kind of stay in this work because it also reminds me where I came from, where I don't want to go back to. I mean, it's just this beautiful circular thing. And I mean, people in recovery are just my favorite people.
Yeah. And you know, it's our PhD, right? That's what, you know, people say, well, what training do I need to do? Actually, our most important qualification is our lived experience. And I love that.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just do that through some study. You've got to live it.
Yeah.
And it's really important.
Amazing. All right. Well, look, thank you so much. And just to end on, Amanda, any kind of final words for those people who are counting their days? They're up to day 7, or maybe they strung 60 days together and then last night someone convinced them to have a drink. What do you want to say to those people who are still grinding through those tricky times of transition?
Yeah, definitely don't give up. Because each day you do becomes more and more empowering. And, you know, what I want to say, my life changed for the better and just soared once I stopped. So every day celebrate, you know, even if it's going down and having an ice cream by the water, go down and celebrate that and keep going because it'll be worth it. Life is so much richer when you're not drinking.
Amazing. Thank you. Appreciate you. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday and I'll see you at work most likely.
Indeed. Thanks, Lotta. It's been really great. Anytime. Bye.